Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, July 1st, 2014, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. Well, here's some good news for you. Mercury finally went direct this morning. Yay! Although it may take a few days for it to get back up to normal, but we're just glad to report this. So the Autumn Crystal Quest starts on the next equinox, September 21st to 27th. So if you feel drawn to crystals, you want to reconnect with your soul family, and your chart has 25, 26, 27 degrees in any of these signs, Taurus, Scorpio, Cancer, Capricorn, Aquarius, or Leo, then you have the rites of passage to participate. And if you're not sure if you have those markings, just send an email to crystals@starseedhotline.com for more details. So we are welcoming author, lecturer, and journalist Nick Redfern back to the show this evening. Nick is a diligent researcher of esoteric subjects from UFOs to government conspiracies, alien encounters, and legends around Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, and unsolved mysteries. He's a prolific writer with a long list of titles, the newest of which is Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind, delving into the so-called accidental deaths of many UFO researchers and witnesses. Nick has appeared on numerous TV shows, including Ancient Aliens, Fox News, UFO Hunters, and VH1's Legend Hunters. You can contact him at nickredfern14, that's N-I-C-K, Redfern, R-E-D-F-E-R-N, and Fortean is F-O-R-T-E-A-N, nickredfern14.blogspot.com, and he'll be joining us right after the news. We'll be starting this evening with Anastasia's Starseed News segments, bringing us topics that you won't hear about in the mainstream media. And we would like to thank Vanya for hosting the switchboard this evening. And you can call in with comments or questions for Nick on 917-889-8292. And remember to press 1 when you're prompted so we know you have a question. And if you like the show, please click follow on our page and you'll get a weekly announcement about our next show. We also have an online Starseed community at starseedhotline.ning.com, and special thanks go to Tammy for her dedication to the forum. Starseed Hotline's toll-free number is 888-881-0881. The Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings and your natal astrological chart, and the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone session available with Lavendar, Anastasia, or myself. Remote healing sessions for people and pets are also available with Tammy. And if you have a birthday coming up, you can find out how to make the most of your 10 hours of power by requesting your solar return timing. So first this evening, I would like to introduce Anastasia and the Starseed News.
Good evening, everybody. It's great to be with you. Today's July 1st. Yeah, I'm so glad Mercury's going direct.
Yeah, it's good news.
This has been a tough retrograde for me. I say that every time, but man, I'm always glad to see it go.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, NASA has postponed a launch today, the launch of NASA's Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2, originally scheduled for today, was delayed 24 hours because of a technical problem at the launch site. The Delta II rocket is now scheduled to lift off from California's Vandenberg Air Force Base on July 2nd at 2:56:44 Pacific Daylight Time. Now, because the launch occurs on a nearly moonless night, the event could be visible to the naked eye, they say, for hundreds of miles, perhaps as far away as portions of Nevada, Arizona, and Mexico. Fun. And on the sun, big sunspot AR2104 emerged over the weekend, and it has developed a beta-gamma-delta magnetic field that does harbor energy for X-class solar flares. So far, the sunspot has been relatively quiet, producing no more than just a few minor C flares, but NOAA forecasters estimate a growing 40% chance of M-class flares and a 5% chance of X flares during the next 24 hours. They say the odds of geo-effective eruptions will increase even more in the days ahead as the sunspot turns toward Earth. And today, July 1st, there were 1,486 potentially hazardous asteroids. They have discovered something amazing. A team of astronomers at the University of New South Wales has discovered a super Earth orbiting near the inner edge of the habitable zone of Gliese 832. Now, this is 16 light years away from Earth and is an M15 dwarf located in the constellation Grus, about 16, like I said, 16 light years away. That's not very far at all. It has about half the mass and radius of the Sun. It's an exoplanet with an orbital period of 35.68 days, a mass 5.4 times that of Earth, and receives about the same energy as the Earth does from the Sun. They say that Gliese 832c might have Earth-like temperatures. It probably will have large seasonal shifts, but a similar terrestrial atmosphere. And that is being added now to the habitable exoplanets catalog. That's hard to say. The habitable exoplanets catalog. And now, with the addition of Gliese 832c, it has 23 objects of interest. Wow. 23
wow.
Possible habitable planets have been targeted for further study. Well, a pair of thunderstorms just tore up the Chicago area yesterday evening with high winds. They say near constant lightning and torrential rainfall. Now, the National Weather Service gave the greatest rainfall for that area at over 4 inches, and a tornado warning was issued in Cook County. Those same storm cells moved through the southern suburbs of Chicago and into northwest Indiana. The National Weather Service further reported that 200 to 300 trees were downed in the town of Morris, about 60 miles southwest of Chicago, and many of the roads are blocked by trees and downed power lines, and up to 90% of the town was left without power. Well, here's a very interesting story out of Las Vegas. For over the months, I've been covering stories about water in the West. When you go to Las Vegas, what you see are fountains shooting 500 feet into the air, performing music with the music of Frank Sinatra in the background. There's swimming pools that stretch for acres. There's countless sprinklers that keep the golf courses green in the middle of the desert. But they say very clearly, scientists are indicating, the endless supply of water is coming to a halt. We are 14 years into a devastating drought for Las Vegas and all of the West. They say we're on the verge of losing all of that. They say the situation is as bad as anybody can imagine. And unless we can find a way to get more water from somewhere, Las Vegas is out of business. They're still building, and that's really stupid. This was a quote from a scientist at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Now, the crisis stems from Las Vegas' complete reliance on Lake Mead, which is America's largest reservoir, located 25 miles outside the city, and it supplies 90% of Las Vegas' water. But over the last decade alone, Las Vegas' population has grown from 400,000 to 2 million. And Lake Mead has slowly been drained of 4 trillion gallons of water and is now well under half full. They say that the lake currently looks as if somebody removed a plug from it, because there's a big bathtub ring where the water level used to be. And they say that Lake Mead has two pipes. They're called straws, and they take the water from these pipes to Las Vegas. And the first pipe extracts water at an elevation of 1,000 feet. They say that by now it's likely to be sucking air. The second straw is just a little bit lower than that, 50 feet lower. And they say that Lake Mead is expected to fall another 20 feet towards the critical point by the end of the year. Now, Las Vegas wants to build a separate $15 billion pipeline that would pump 27 billion gallons of groundwater a year from an aquifer 260 miles away in rural Nevada. But a judge has refused permission after environmentalists sued on the basis that it would adversely affect 5,500 acres of meadows, 33 miles of trout streams and 130,000 acres of habitat used by sage-grouse, mule deer, elk, and pronghorn. So the court heard that 25 species of Great Basin spring snails would be made extinct by this measure. Well, a scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity has said that as the water situation becomes more dire, we're going to start having to talk about the removal of human beings from Las Vegas. Now, Las Vegas gets just 4 inches of rain in a good year. In the first 4 months of this year, there was only a third of an inch. So there's pressure now from the, to take water from the state of California. But 100% of California is now classified as in a severe drought. And did you know the rivers are so low that 27 million young migrating salmon are having to be taken to the ocean in trucks?
Oh, my.
Wow, yeah. So they say that the Colorado River is also drying up. They say that Las Vegas and the American Southwest is going to be imperiled eventually because of the water shortages. It's grown too fast, too much. And they're pulling up grass, by the way. Some cities are paying people $1.50, a square foot, I think it is, to pull up their grass, trying to get people to stop watering lawns and things like that. But it's not just Las Vegas that has a problem. There has been a disaster declaration for all of the state of Utah. Every county in Utah now will be covered by a disaster declaration because of the ongoing drought. And all but two of Utah counties were previously included in the disaster area, and the latest move covers the rest of the state. So Utah is also in serious trouble with their water from less than average snowpack. Farmers are worried about their animals, their livestock, and they're worried about a more dangerous wildfire season. So the West is in dire trouble for water. And in Sweden, tornadoes have hit the West Coast. A concentrated storm front with thunderclouds moved in on Friday morning over the west coast of Sweden and spawned tornadoes on Sunday. And they say, and you know, that just struck me as so odd that there were going to be any tornadoes in Sweden at all, but local meteorologists stated, now these are people from Sweden, that there have been more tornadoes than normal for this time of year. So I guess they do have them. But I wouldn't think of that, would you, that Sweden never had tornadoes. But that's what they said. Well, there's been a lot of earthquake activity in the last since our last session, our last news program. According to the USGS, there was a 6.2 magnitude earthquake on the Bonin Islands just off of Japan. And we're going to cover some more earthquakes as I continue with this news story. 6.2 is a pretty good-sized earthquake. And the thermohaline circulation is a global ocean current that redistributes warm surface water and cold, dense, deep water throughout the oceans. They say a dramatic slowdown in deep ocean currents matches a major reset in Earth's ice ages about 1 million years ago. They have just discovered this. This is new findings, and they believe that the Earth's oceans are what significantly alter its climate. Well, you know, we're seeing the same type of disruption now of the ocean currents because there have been records or reports about the North Atlantic current disappearing. So we'll see what happens with that. And here's a story for you. Talk about weird animal behavior. You wouldn't expect to go shopping in a mall and see a mountain lion having a browse, doing some window shopping. But that's exactly what happened in Salt Lake City. Shoppers were stunned when they spotted a wild animal, a cougar, sometimes people call them pumas or panthers, was outside of a doorway and began to take a stroll through the mall. Big Cat was caught on camera wandering through the Jordan Commons Center in Sandy, Utah, about 8 o'clock yesterday. They say the cougar wandered through the center before settling down in the doorway of a steak restaurant. I think that's a pretty smart cat. That's what it said. Wow. Well, in Massachusetts, in Fall River, they have discovered something very unusual. They say it's the wrong time and the wrong place to spot a rare Arctic beluga whale. It was spotted in the Taunton River over the past several days. They say it's very rare to see a beluga whale by itself this far south. It was sighted here a week ago. They say that the belugas prefer Arctic and subarctic waters, and they travel in pods. It was unusual because this whale was alone. It's the wrong time and the wrong place. So they don't know why, and they say that they're trying to investigate it. Aquarium owners and experts and zoologists are looking into this, not knowing what in the world made this whale leave its pod and come so far south in the wrong time of the year to top that off. In Hawaii, there's new activity at another volcano. We've been talking about volcanoes at the Pu'o Crater, and I'm sorry if I didn't say that right, Pu'o. On Friday morning, lava broke out at four locations on the crater's northeast flank. It did produce a channel flow that had traveled nearly a mile. So they say that they're keeping an eye on that, and it's being watched by the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. And there's been flooding in the Midwest. Residents of several Midwest states, they say they don't want any more rain. River levels have soared over the past few weeks in South Dakota, Nebraska, Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. It's been flooding towns, killing crops, and even setting off a mudslide in Minneapolis. The Mississippi River, they say, has been pushed into major flood stage in the Twin Cities, as have 50-year-old levees, so they are in real trouble there with water. Another earthquake that I want to tell you about is occurred in an odd place. I had to look this up. This is near American Samoa and Fiji. It was a 6.7 earthquake south-southeast of Mata'utu. So that is in the American Samoa and Fiji region. And another earthquake, 6.4, off Tonga, occurred on Sunday. These are all on Sunday, by the way. And another eruption of Indonesia's Mount Sinabung occurred on Sunday that produced a powerful burst of hot ash. They say that it was 4,000 meters high and triggered massive evacuations. And in Douglas, Arizona, there was a 5.2 earthquake on Sunday. And on Sunday also, a magnitude 6.9 earthquake off the coast of Argentina and the Falkland Islands, north-northwest of Visoykoy Island. Never heard of Visoykoy Island, but it's off Argentina and the Falklands. Also on Sunday in Japan, another earthquake, 6.2 off the coast of Iwo Jima. At least a million fish carcasses have lined the banks and waterways of the Winwa Bay in Georgetown County in South Carolina after a massive fish kill occurred earlier this last week. Officials with the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources said that it was one of the largest fish kills they've ever seen, up to a million animals, and they don't know what's caused it. Here's a wonderful story, and I think that all the women out there are really going to relate to this. In France, they've come up with, actually it's in Paris, by the way, they have come up with a problem solution, a solution to a problem that all us women face when we go to get our cars repaired. Somebody came up with a great idea of, well, they built an Only Girls garage. Only Girls. It's a brand new garage and a brand new business idea that's designed to make women feel comfortable. It has women mechanics, and they say they did this because they are catering to women who are tired of being shortchanged by deceitful mechanics. It opened in a suburb of Paris just a month ago, and it already has 40 customers. They say two-thirds of which were women. I'm surprised it wasn't all women. But they say the concept of an all-female garage stands to be a big hit because Only Girls aims to offer women motorists exactly what they need, respect. Many women claim to have a tough time getting their cars fixed at regular garages because mechanics don't take women seriously and do quote higher prices than they would for male customers. And one customer at this Only Girls garage said, when you're a woman, it's like you've got sucker tattooed on your forehead. One time I went around to three different garages and got three different estimates. Since then, I've been to Only Girls, and the prices have dropped. It's reasonable. They have a wonderful entertainment options for the women. They can, it's a stress-free experience while they're waiting to get their cars fixed. They have a beautiful waiting room with pretty wallpaper, hardwood floors, velvet sofas, and flickering candles. They also have a children's playroom and a beauty corner where women can get their nails done.
Oh, that's great.
It's worth living in Paris just to have that option. Isn't that fun? I thought that was real cute.
Yeah.
Well, that's all for tonight's news, Arielle. It's going to be a great show tonight.
It sure is. We have Nick Redfern actually on the switchboard now, so I want to thank you, Anastasia, for the Starseed News segment.
It's great. Okay. We'll talk to you next week, everybody. Have a beautiful week, Starseed.
Okay. Bye-bye. So let me get Lavendar. You are online, so let me get your microphone open here, Nick. Hey, Nick, welcome back to the show.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me back on again.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And I know Lavendar has been reading your new book, and she's going to take the lead this evening and talk about close encounters. So, Lavendar?
I'm here. Okay. Oh, Nick, I'm so glad that you're on our show tonight, and I've been reading on this book most of the day, and it's totally, you know, got my brain.
Oh, cool.
It's like I know a lot of this information, but a lot of it I hadn't heard before, so I'm just really happy that you have written the book Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind, because there's a lot of suspicious deaths that have happened through the years with UFO researchers, and I've had a few Tesla kids that were taken out of their prime by the government because they invented energy devices. So I know a little bit about this. But, Nick, welcome, and I heard that you were on Coast to Coast the other night.
Yeah, I did Coast to Coast Sunday night through Saturday morning. Monday morning. that was sort of 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. my time, but sort of a long haul, but I always enjoy doing Coast to Coast, and it actually goes by quite quickly when you're in it. You don't realize you're doing 3 hours. So.
Well, good. Well, I don't even know where to start, so I'll just let you pick a subject or a person that you want to talk about. There is just so much in here. The one that really kind of captured me was about Hunrath and Wilkinson. That one really mystified me. If you'd like to start with that one, it'd be okay by me.
Yeah, sure. Well, this deals with two men, Carl Hunrath and Wilbur Wilkinson, relates to events that occur between 1952 and 1953. And both Hunrath and Wilkinson, originally from Wisconsin, and both of them had an interest in the UFO phenomenon and had done so since 1947, when the sort of so-called modern era of ufology began. Well, Hunrath, who was single, moved to Los Angeles to live in early 1952 because he felt that if he was going to get the answers to the UFO mystery, that's where he should be, because a lot of the sort of leading lights in ufology of that era lived in L.A. This included a lot of the early contactees like George Van Tassel, George Adamski, people like this, and a lot of the authors and researchers too. And Wilkinson moved a few months later with his family, and they started investigating the whole UFO phenomenon more and more. And they hooked up with another contactee, a man named George Hunt Williamson, who lived out in Arizona. They spent a lot of time in the desert at Hunt Williamson's home, which, you know, there was no light pollution or anything at all, and it's sort of the perfect place to see the skies. And they claimed over time to have actually made sort of psychic contact with extraterrestrials. And the story was that Hunrath and Wilkinson were sort of invited by these extraterrestrials to meet them at a prearranged place that neither man actually ever admitted to or never actually revealed. So we don't know where this was going to take place. What we do know, however, is that on November the 10th, 1953, Hunrath and Wilkinson took to the skies from a small airport in California, just outside L.A., and were never seen again. And this was actually the day when they were supposedly having this rendezvous with these extraterrestrials. Now, there was a very rapid emergency services, you know, response to this event, and spotter planes were sent up to try and find any evidence that their plane had crashed somewhere, either soon after takeoff or on some of the nearby mountains. Nothing was ever found at all. There was sort of no telltale fires or smokestacks, no wreckage, nothing. And that's been the case ever since in November 53. For all intents and purposes, they'd completely vanished. Now, of course, with the emergency services involved, it didn't take long before the media picked up on the story. And they actually went round to visit Mrs. Wilkinson to get her side of the story. And she told the local L.A. newspapers about how her husband and Hunrath had had this fascination for UFOs, and they were supposedly having this rendezvous with extraterrestrials. And Mrs. Wilkinson actually invited the press into the basement where Wilkinson kept all his files and records, etc. And it turns out that the entire walls of the basement have been scrawled in this very strange writing, almost like ancient hieroglyphics. And nobody could decipher it, but Mrs. Wilkinson said that Wilbur Wilkinson, her husband, had done all this writing. Essentially, it's supposed to have been channeled, the information. Channeling, for people who aren't aware, is when sort of higher entities, whether aliens or supernatural creatures, essentially sort of mainline information right down into your brain. And that's supposedly what happened with Wilkinson. He was channeled all this data and then wrote it all down on the walls. But he just, no one was able to decipher it. Nobody had the code. And the upshot was that nothing was ever found of them. They literally vanished into oblivion. There were stories about they were perhaps going over to the border to Mexico. Somebody else wondered if they were Russian spies and all sorts of weird and wacky theories. But what it came down to was that they just were never seen again after this very day when they were supposed to have this meeting with the aliens.
Well, didn't one of them have some kind of spooky machine that would take an airplane out? Can you tell us a little bit about that technology?
Yeah, sure. Well, this was Hunrath. Carl Hunrath claimed that during these sort of mind-to-mind encounters with the aliens, that they told him how to build this device which could actually bring down military any sort of aircraft. And for some weird reason, Hunrath actually gave it a name. He called it Bosco. And he would actually refer to it like in the first person, even though it was sort of this shoebox-sized little machine. Now, it kind of sounds bizarre, the idea that he'd been given the sort of secret technology to build an aircraft-destroying machine, which he would carry around with him in this little box. But what's really weird is that, as I mentioned when we started, Wilkinson and Hunrath were both from Wisconsin, a little town called Racine. Now, just an hour's drive from Racine, there's a military base called Trow Airfield. And just 13 days after Hunrath and Wilkinson disappeared, there were two mysterious events involving military aircraft in just outside of, just like an hour's drive from Racine, Wisconsin. In one case, an aircraft crashed. In the other one, it vanished into oblivion like Hunrath and Wilkinson. But some researchers believe that because Hunrath and Wilkinson were originally from Wisconsin and Hunrath claims to have this aircraft-destroying technology, what were the chances of two military aircraft coming to grief just a small distance from where Hunrath lived and after he disappeared? So some people thought his disappearance wasn't the disappearance it seemed to be, and that he was intent on using this technology to bring down American aircraft. And by his own admission, he was someone, for some weird reason, who didn't have any love for his government and may well have decided to do this. And the two incidents in question, one of the aircraft crashed on the morning of November the 23rd, 1953. It took to the skies and then suddenly plunged into like a small pool, like a mini lake just on the edge of the airfield. Both pilots were killed, or both crew members, I should say, were killed, and they had to bring in heavy lifting equipment to extract the remains of the plane out of the deep mud. But a number of people reported seeing this flying saucer-type craft hovering around the area only moments before and after the aircraft crashed. Now, as I said, in that case, the aircraft was recovered and the bodies of the crew members were as well. But later that evening, another aircraft, an identical one, these were basically U.S. Air Force fighter planes, another one also came to grief. This one didn't crash. It actually literally just vanished. What happened was the plane was on like a routine mission when the ground crew at the base said, hey, we're tracking an unusual object flying over Lake Michigan, Lake Superior. And so the pilot was vectored onto the lake to try and intercept this object to see what it was. and he reported closing in on it, and then there was just total radio silence, after which the ground radar personnel saw the two blips on the screen merge into one. One theory was that they'd collided, but if they were collided, that theory was sort of confounded by the fact that no wreckage was ever found at all, despite very quick intensive searches and also divers going down very deep into the lake. Nothing was ever found at all. Another theory was that this unidentified target was a huge UFO, and it actually was of considerable size. The radar return showed that. So the theory was that this UFO had actually kidnapped the plane and the crew. And like Wilkinson and Hunrath, just 13 days before, they were never seen again, and the aircraft was never seen again. So it was a very, very weird situation with no less than six people either dead or vanished, and three planes all gone. And you have this Wisconsin tie to all the stories, and with one of the guys having an aircraft destroying technology, supposedly, and they all just either vanish or die. It's a very weird and ominous story.
Yeah, it was a very, very interesting chapter. I want to change the subject a little bit now. And, you know, when President Clinton got into office, he asked his assistant attorney general, Webster Hubble, to get to the bottom of two questions that he really wanted to know. One, who killed President John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963, and do UFOs really exist? So can you give us what happened with Clinton and his wanting to know these answers, and give us a little bit about what you think that JFK really knew and what he was about to tell the world?
Yeah, well, I'm sure when Clinton asked those questions of Hubble, he didn't realize that a great deal of research has been done that suggests the two issues may well be connected. Unfortunately for Clinton, bearing in mind that he was the president, even Hubble couldn't get the answers for him. You know, he didn't find any sort of smoking gun that suggested it was the KGB that killed Kennedy, or it was the Cubans or the Mafia or whoever. Hubble just couldn't find anything substantial. And it was the same on the UFO subject. All he was able to get was the official party line that the Air Force had dropped its investigations back in 69, and that was it. So even the president couldn't get beyond, you know, that particular angle. But what is sort of very weird but also fascinating are the many strands that run through both the UFO subject and the Kennedy assassination that link the two together. And, you know, it sounds like the ultimate conspiracy sci-fi story until you realize how deep the connections run. For example, back in 1947, there was an alleged UFO crash at a place called Maury Island in Tacoma, and the wreckage was recovered by a man named Fred Chrisman. And Chrisman was someone who had a great deal of intriguing and shadowy ties with the world of intelligence and espionage. He actually popped up in the Kennedy assassination in 63, when none other than Jim Garrison, who was portrayed in the JFK movie by Kevin Costner. And he actually came to believe that Chrisman was one of the gunmen in the Kennedy assassination. And it turns out that Chrisman was also a friend and colleague of a man named Guy Bannister, who was an FBI agent in the summer of 47, who investigated many UFO reports for the FBI in that time period, and who also popped up in the Kennedy assassination. He was portrayed in the JFK movie by Ed Asner. And in the film, you know, we don't hear about UFOs, but both men were heavily involved at an official level with UFOs in 47. Both of them turn up in the Kennedy assassination. They were also both linked with Lee Harvey Oswald, had deep ties with him. And there's also a UFO connection in Iran, Oswald himself. And that connection is that just before the assassination, Oswald was working for a Fort Worth company called Jaggers, Charles & Stovall. They did contract work for the intelligence community, where they would analyze aerial photographs of things like Russian military bases and Cuban missile bases, that kind of thing. And it turns out that all the analyses of these pictures that Oswald undertook were of imagery taken by the U-2 spy plane. And the U-2 spy plane was actually developed at a place called the Nellis Range in Nevada, which is better known as Area 51. And there are so many themes that run through the assassination like that. A really interesting one is on the very day before he was shot dead, Kennedy was killed on November the 22nd. But on November the 21st, he traveled with Mrs. Kennedy to Brooks Air Force Base in Texas, where he opened a new wing dedicated to space medicine. Bear in mind, this was the very early years of the space race, and a great deal wasn't known about how the human body would be affected by low gravity or no gravity. You know, would it affect somebody's blood pressure? Would their muscles degrade and bones crumble if they were in a low gravity environment for too long? So that was the whole theme of this new lab at Brooks Air Force Base. Now, when Kennedy was at Brooks, he had a behind-closed-doors meeting with a man named Major General Theodore Bedwell. And it turns out that Bedwell, in the summer of 1947, held a major medical position at Wright Field, as it was known at the time, where supposedly the bodies from the Roswell crash were taken at the very same time that Bedwell was working there, as I said, in a major medical capacity. And he would have been the ideal person, because of his medical background, to show the unusual bodies to try and figure out what they were. And the list just goes on, you know, as I said, of these threads that one way or another sort of weave in and out of both the Kennedy assassination and the UFO mystery.
Wasn't there something that Kennedy actually said about wanting to get to the bottom of ET investigations? Did he try to pursue that?
Well, yeah, this is one of the major theories as to why he was killed, that because he was on the verge of revealing the truth to the world about what was known at an official level about the UFO phenomenon. And whoever was running the UFO program was clearly sort of more powerful than the government itself. This has given rise to the idea that the real deep UFO secrets actually aren't held by the government, but more like a sort of a powerful shadow agency that operates outside of government. And I think there's a lot of merit to that. But people have come forward, retired military people, to say they'd heard stories of how Kennedy was sick and tired of the UFO secrecy and basically told his people, you know, I'm going to blow the whistle, I'm going to tell everybody, and that's just how it's going to be. And, of course, then for the people who decided that wasn't going to be how it's going to be, you know, the countdown was on to his assassination. But he actually did two things that we can prove through the Freedom of Information Act. One was that in the days leading up to his assassination, he actually told NASA that he intended opening up the whole issue of outer space exploration with the Russians. And the second thing was that not only was he going to open up sort of future exploration, he wanted to share data with the Russians that had been collated and put together by NASA and other agencies in relation to what are termed in the documents as outer space activities. And this was sort of seen as the last straw, supposedly, that, you know, it was one thing to sort of tell the American people, yes, UFOs are real, but it was a totally different thing to say we're going to open up our space program and our investigation of space to the Russians and share everything. Now, that document is not like a questionable document or a potentially hoaxed one. This has actually surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act. It's a real document. And, of course, this was all cut short when Kennedy was shot. But we can, you know, when we look at all this together, it does sort of paint a picture of Kennedy speaking to people in the right place, like Theodore Bedwell, coming together and trying to figure out who knew what and trying to find the answers. And then this sort of shadow group employing characters like Fred Chrisman to carry out their dirty work. And it just so happens people like Chrisman had been in on the UFO secrecy from back in 47.
Wow. That all just, it's like a thread that just keeps making this tapestry bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
I remember Bill Cooper and William Cooper, and when he first came out with his information about MJ-12 and everything. Why don't you bring us up to date on what happened to Bill Cooper and why it happened?
Well, yeah, I mean, Bill Cooper was a noted conspiracy theorist who surfaced in the late 1980s, and he talked a great deal about, for example, the government having in its possession crashed UFOs, dead alien bodies, and that there was this sort of huge cover-up of the fact that we were being visited by extraterrestrials. He wrote a book called Behold a Pale Horse, which sort of outlined his entire theory that covered everything from sort of ancient societies, groups like the Illuminati, government secrecy surrounding UFOs, the Kennedy assassination, the moon landings, all sorts of different things that essentially came to cross paths. Now, a few years later, Cooper actually changed some of his views, where he came to believe that a lot of the documents that he claimed to have read that told this story may have been fabricated, and at least part of his story changed to where he now felt that much of the UFO secrecy was fabricated because he saw it that like a faked alien threat was going to be the next big threat to try and take away people's rights. That's what he said. You know, we're going to be sort of frightened into submitting our freedoms by what essentially would amount to a fabricated UFO invasion that actually wasn't really going to involve extraterrestrials, but it would be sort of specially created craft and to make it look like an alien invasion. But ironically, for someone who spent a great deal of time digging into the Kennedy assassination, Cooper himself ended up dead by the bullet. What happened was that in the summer of 1998, he was formed, he was charged with tax evasion. He hadn't paid tax in years. And so sheriff's deputies went out to his Arizona home to basically bring him in to arrest him. And he shot one of the deputies and killed him. And so the police shot back and killed Cooper. So, you know, it was almost like an eerily chilling parallel of what happened to Kennedy. You know, he writes about it, researches it, and then, you know, comes to an end in a shootout. But as I said, the circumstances were very different. You know, he was due to be arrested for not paying taxes, and he shot first. So, you know, you can't really blame him for firing back.
Yeah, right. Well, I know when his death happened, I was very saddened, and it was a real wake-up call for a lot of us when that took place. I'd like to go to another subject now of Morris Ketchum Jessup. That is a very interesting chapter. So just tell us what you know about this man and his work.
Well, yeah, sure. Well, Morris Jessup was somebody who got involved in the UFO subject in the early 1950s, and he, like a lot of people in that era, was fascinated by, you know, the stories of Kenneth Arnold and his famous UFO encounter in 1947 that really began the UFO phenomenon and the contactee movement. But he was also very interested in the whole ancient astronaut scenario, you know, where the idea that some of our ancient structures like the pyramids and the similar pyramids in South America and Stonehenge, things like this. He came to view the idea that these massive stone structures could really only have been built with the benefit of extraterrestrials. And he came to the conclusion that the construction methods must have been something like levitation or anti-gravity to move these multi-ton stones. Now, bear in mind, this was like 1951, 52. This is almost 20 years before Eric von Daniken came along, and, you know, sort of 30 years or more before Zechariah Sitchin was on the scene. So he's very much like a pioneer in the ancient astronauts world. And he wrote a number of books in the 1950s, but certainly Jessup's most famous book was called The Case for the UFO. And it basically outlined, or detailed, I should say, all his theories and supporting data came from various UFO reports and his own personal visits to Mexico and South America to examine and study these huge structures that built in the distant past. Well, something strange happened just after the case for the UFO was published. An anonymous copy of the book was mailed to a special weapons division with the Navy, and it was filled with all these scribblings and writings related to the so-called Philadelphia experiment, as it's become known, this reported experiment in the Philadelphia Naval Yard in 43 to try and make a warship invisible, so, you know, be invisible to the Germans, so to speak, reportedly went wrong, and there were stories about some of the crew members dying, some going insane, others vanishing completely, and the ship itself sort of temporarily either going invisible or teleporting from one place to another. And all of these sort of details were were written anonymously in this copy of the book mailed to the Navy. And with hindsight, it looks like the Navy was very concerned that somebody had compromised a top-secret project, namely this invisibility program. So they called up Jessup and said, hey, we've got a copy of your book mailed to us. It's got all these markings inside it and claims. We'd like to speak to you about it. Now, Jessup was kind of excited on the one hand that the Navy was taking an interest in his book, but he's also a bit concerned as well, as, you know, you might imagine he would be. But he accepted their invite of, you know, a flight out to D.C., and they would cover his hotel room and all his food and et cetera, et cetera. And so he flew out. He was kind of anticipating, I think, sort of a good cop, bad cop situation. But it was actually a very relaxed meeting where the Navy said, look, we've got this copy of your book. It makes all these sorts of claims about this particular experiment. Do you know who could have written all these annotations? Because we want to find out. And when they passed over the copy of the book to Jessup, he recognized the handwriting as being that of a man named Miguel Allende, who claimed to be one of involved or a participant in or a witness of some of these experiments in invisibility. And so Jessup said, well, yes, it's this guy who's been sending me letters, and that kind of satisfied the Navy. But as I said, with hindsight, it does sound that even though it was a relaxed meeting, they were concerned as to who was going to hear about this story. And something even stranger happened a week or so after he got back home, namely that he started to get hang-up phone calls in the middle of the night. They would sort of wake him up at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning. And, of course, you know, if you get a middle-of-the-night phone call, everybody, no matter where you live in the world, your first thought is, it's bad news. So he kept getting up to answer the phone, you know, just in case. And it really disturbed his sleep patterns badly. On top of that, he would get other strange phone calls where there would be sort of weird electronic screeching noises and bleeps down the line, and sometimes what sounded like a foreign language, but not a recognizable foreign language, but speaking very, very quickly, almost as if speeded up. And this sort of really disturbed him and made him really sort of anxious and paranoid even. And his paranoia got even worse when one particular day in late 58, he was driving his car and inexplicably swerved off the road into a ditch and was actually quite badly injured. It took him several weeks to recover, and he never really got over it properly. And Jessup came to believe that some sort of external force, is probably the best way to describe it, had sort of taken control of his mind and his mental faculties and had forced him to drive off the side of the road. And he felt that whatever this was had actually tried to kill him. Now, his paranoia sort of reached massive depths then, and depression set in because of his illness, and he was laid up in hospital for weeks, unable to sort of move his leg properly. He badly injured his leg. Now, when he came out, his depression and anxiety actually began to lift a little bit. And one particular evening, he phoned a good friend of his, Dr. Manson Valentine, who was doing similar research into ancient structures of the distant past and how they might have been built. And Jessup told Valentine, I've uncovered something amazing and you're not going to believe it. Can we meet tomorrow to discuss it? You know, he sounded full on galvanized and enthusiastic. And Ballantyne said, well, yeah, sure. You know, where do you want to meet? And so they arranged to meet at a cafe for lunch. But that never happened because the following day, Jessup was found dead in his car in a Florida park. And he was actually found by a guy who was sort of who worked at the park and was doing the rounds, making sure nobody was going to be left in the park when it was locked up at 5 o'clock. He saw Jessup's car near to the edge of the lake inside the park and went over and saw that the engine was running and that there was a hose pipe going from the exhaust through the driver's window. We just sort of, you know, it just been open enough to slide the pipe in. So he raced over and opened the door and was hit by this sort of strong, overpowering smell of carbon monoxide. And there was Jessup dead in the car. Now, what was very weird is that Jessup's body was never autopsied. And the rationale behind this was that, well, it looks like he committed suicide by carbon monoxide poisoning, so that must have been what it was. And he was just very quickly buried, with no autopsy at all. Now, you don't have to be like a scientist or a forensic analyst to know that if somebody dies of carbon monoxide poisoning, they die from it because they breathe it in, it gets into their system and it kills them. But if the person is already dead when they're put in the car, then clearly they don't breathe any carbon monoxide in because they're already dead. So their blood oxygen level would be normal. No one thought to do that. On top of that, there were towels. Basically, what he'd done, he sort of lowered the window down about an inch to get the hose pipe in. But the windows around that one-inch space had all been blocked up with towels. So whoever did it, whether it was Jessup or somebody else, the fact is that steps have been taken to make sure no carbon monoxide could leak out of that one-inch gap in the window at all. Now, Mrs. Jessup confirmed that the towels weren't from the family home. Now, you know, you can never really say what goes through a person's mind when they do decide to kill themselves, but it does seem strange that he would have gone out and bought new towels instead of just taking a couple with him from, you know, from the cupboard, so to speak, or the bathroom. And a third mystery was that the towels had been soaked to allow them to sort of, you know, stick inside the windows. But the water in which they were soaked wasn't from the lake. We know that because the lake was pretty dirty, and this was clear water, like tap water. Now, people could argue that, well, perhaps he bought like a large jug with him or a bowl and wet the towels that way. Well, that would be fine, except there was no telltale jug or container or anything at the scene, which kind of suggested that somebody else had wet the towels and then had fled the scene. So when you put all these angles together, then we're sort of clearly faced with a very illogical scenario where there's no autopsy. Everything about the window and the towels and the water makes no sense at all. And yet there was no autopsy, and his burial was essentially just rushed through. And that was the end of Maurice Jessup. And his death still sort of provokes controversy to this day. Some people think it was like an outright murder. Other people think that he may have been the victim of like directed energy technology. There are technologies today, certain acoustic technologies, which can be directed to a person and at the right frequency can actually provoke like depression and anxiety. And one of the theories is that he was a target of these sort of lethal weapons, if you like, and it put him in, and it was designed to deliberately put him in such a depressed state that he himself would sort of commit the ultimate act. So in that sense, as I point out in the book, you could argue that it's like a combination of murder and suicide. It's a suicide, but one that was provoked by sort of rendering him into this altered state of a depressed mind via possibly mind-altering technologies.
Yeah, I when I read that, I felt like that they were really messing with his mm-hmm. brain and mind control experiments, and they had been doing some LSD and some mind expansion things, and so that's what I concluded when I read it. I said, oh yeah, that's how they got him. Tell us a little bit about Dorothy Kilgallen. She was a famous author, and she had ties to Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe and UFOs. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, Dorothy Kilgallen was a well-respected journalist from the 19—certainly throughout the late 40s, 50s, and 60s, and up until the time of her death in 1965. And although she was sort of largely noted for sort of gossip column-type work, she was actually a very good investigative journalist, to the point where the FBI actually opened an extensive file on her. It's now surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act, and runs to a couple of hundred pages. And because J. Edgar Hoover was very interested to read everything she said, because she seemed to have, like, you know, an eye on everything that was going on in Washington, and she had all sorts of contacts and leads. So, you know, to portray her as somehow as just like a gossip columnist is actually sort of far and wide of the mark. And as far as the whole UFO, Marilyn Monroe, JFK issue is concerned, it all began in 1955 when she traveled to England with her husband. And while she was over there, although she was on holiday, she was still mindful of picking up any good stories. And she said that when she was over there, she was able to speak with a high-ranking British government official who told her, sort of off the record, that the British government had got their hands on a crashed UFO and that it was supposedly piloted by what they described as, quote, small men. And when she got back to the U.S., she actually wrote this story up for the Los Angeles Examiner newspaper and told the whole thing. And that's what really got her interested in UFOs in 1955. Now, the story itself gets even more controversial, because in 1995, a document surfaced from a man named Milo Spiriglio. Milo Spiriglio is now dead, but he wrote three books on the death of Marilyn Monroe, and he was like a full-on believer that her death wasn't just accident or suicide or, you know, an accidental overdose of drugs, that it was actually a case of murder. And Spiriglio said that he had received a document that hadn't surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act, but came through sort of whistleblower means, if you like. That's the best way to describe it. And it was purported to be a CIA document that was a transcript of a wiretap of a telephone conversation between Dorothy Kilgallen and a mutual friend of Kilgallen and Marilyn Monroe, a man named Howard Rothberg. And the story that the document tells is that Rothberg and Kilgallen were talking about how Marilyn Monroe had told both of them that she was sick and tired about how she'd been treated by JFK, and that supposedly JFK had told her all sorts of secrets, government secrets, about plans to invade Cuba, plans to assassinate Fidel Castro, the current relationship with the Soviets, all sorts of, you know, things that would be highly classified in the White House at that time. Now, although many people have sort of unfairly portrayed her as this, you know, dumb, blonde character, she actually wasn't. She was very clever, very intelligent, had a deep interest in world affairs and poetry, and read sort of voraciously. And she also kept this diary that became known as the Red Book. She kept a lot of journals, but the Red Book was supposedly the one where she would keep all the information that the Kennedys had told her. So in other words, it was like filled with all the state secrets. And according to this wiretap of this conversation between Kilgallen and Rothberg, Marilyn Monroe had told both of them that she was going to blow the whistle on everything that Kennedy had told her, and that included supposedly a secret visit that the president had made to an Air Force base, which isn't identified in the document, where he was shown what were described as a spacecraft and dead bodies. You know, the implication being at least that it was something to do with a crashed UFO and Roswell, or possibly Roswell. And from there, the story gets even more ominous, because this document where she threatened to go public was dated just a couple of days before she died. Now, as I said, although the document hasn't been verified as officially 100% legitimate, because it, you know, it didn't surface through the Freedom of Information Act, it was essentially leaked to Milo Spiriglio, for want of a better term. But the paper heading on the document does match the heading that the CIA was using at the time. Also, and this is more important, the typewriter, the typeface, has been actually identified with a typewriter of the sort that the CIA were using in 1962. You know, they had contracts with certain typewriter companies to provide all their typewriters. It was definitely written on one of those typewriters from the early 1960s. So if it's a fake, an awful amount of work has gone into it to make it look like the real thing. And there are a lot of indications that it is the real thing. Now, as I said, the document's dated just a couple of days before Marilyn Monroe's death, which, just like President Kennedy's death, provokes a huge amount of controversy more than 50 years on. And kind of incredibly, Marilyn Monroe, had she survived, would actually be 90 next year, which is just sort of bizarre. But Dorothy Kilgallen, she ended her days mysteriously as well. I'll explain what I mean by that. And this comes back to the Kennedy assassination again. Dorothy Kilgallen was the very last person to interview Jack Ruby. And Jack Ruby was the man who shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald on November the 24th, 1963. And we don't know all the details of what went on in the conversation or the interview between Kilgallen and Jack Ruby. But Kilgallen was going around telling people, which may not have been the right thing or the wise thing to do, that she'd uncovered something majorly significant about the Kennedy assassination, possibly some of it coming from Jack Ruby, and she was going to blow the whistle. Well, unfortunately, she didn't have a chance to blow the whistle because she also ended up dead as well. And the circumstances surrounding her death also were very, very strange. She died on November the 8th, 1965, when she was only 52. And the story was that she was found dead in bed from ethanol and barbiturate intoxication. But she actually just earlier that same night was seen hanging out with friends and was just, you know, totally lucid and normal. This gave rise to the theory that, you know, she'd been poisoned or something had been slipped into a drink that provoked sort of like a massive sort of backlash of her nervous system and killed her. And so she ended up dead. And then Jack Ruby died of a very fast-acting cancer. So all of these players, from Dorothy Kilgallen to Marilyn Monroe to Jack Ruby, all of them ended up dead, and whatever the big secret was just never came out.
Yeah. How many of the people that actually witnessed the JFK assassination, I forgot what that number is, but most of the people that witnessed it that day, they all turned up dead, right?
Yeah, there was actually a large number of people, I mean, certainly more than a dozen, who were right on the scene at the time, who, you know, had weird car accidents or they died supposedly from late night muggings and things like this, or unsolved murders, bodies found at the edge of roadsides, that kind of thing. And the body count is actually really big. There was actually a very good movie made that was based upon all that. It's called The Parallax View with Warren Beatty. And it actually deals in a fictional setting with like this clandestine group that essentially hires assassins to wipe out, you know, powerful figures for money. But it's clearly based around the Kennedy assassination, and one of the characters is clearly based around Dorothy Kilgallen. And it's from the 70s. It's a good movie and very thought-provoking, and kind of offers a scenario that might explain the circumstances around the real assassination, around Kennedy's assassination.
Right. Give us a little insight to the guy named Frank Olson, the chemist.
Yeah, well, this is a really controversial area because this deals with sort of an offshoot of the UFO phenomenon. And I should sort of preface this by saying there's absolutely no doubt that there's a genuine UFO phenomenon from somewhere else. You know, I fully believe that, whether it's extraterrestrial or interdimensional or multidimensional or maybe a combination of all of those factors. But there are genuine UFOs flying around from somewhere else. However, There have also been allegations that over the years there may have been a few staged UFO events in which the witnesses have been sort of exposed to mind-altering drugs and technologies, really to try and see how far the human mind can be manipulated and essentially hoodwinked into seeing something that isn't there, all as a result, as I said, of like mind-altering technologies and hallucinogenic drugs and that kind of thing. And this is where Frank Olson comes into the story. Frank Olson was a big player in the early 1950s era mind control programs, as they became collectively known. And certainly the most famous of them all was a CIA program called MKUltra. Now, Frank Olson was someone who was in almost like a unique position where he actually worked, or crossed paths, I should say, with both the CIA and the military's chemical mind control program or mind manipulation program at Camp Dietrich in Maryland, which is today called Fort Dietrich. So in other words, he had deep connections with both the military and the intelligence community. And what's fascinating about Frank Olson is that he actually had a lot of ties during this very time period with the UFO phenomenon. And he ended up dead himself, which I'll come to shortly, under very weird circumstances. But prior to his death, he, as I said, he was linked with a number of UFO-based events. Now, in 1951, at a place called Pont-Saint-Esprit in France, there was a very strange outbreak of essentially like hallucinatory activity in the villages. People all across the village, this was August 1951, reported seeing strange creatures and devilish entities and these strange menacing little dwarfs running around the neighborhood. And it sounded like something straight out of your worst horror film or nightmare. It turned out that the villagers had actually been affected by some sort of hallucinatory product, if you like. One of the theories was it was due to something called ergot, which is a fungus that affects rye, and which actually can provoke horrific hallucinations. But what was interesting is that we now know that Frank Olson was actually out in that area at the very time in question. And this has given rise to the theory that one of these clandestine mind control programs back then was responsible for sort of unleashing possibly some sort of aerosol-based hallucinatory solution, really to watch the people and see how badly they were affected, and they were badly affected. Now, just a couple of years later, there was another outbreak of very similar activity, which gave rise to the theory that this may have been a further example of French intelligence possibly testing, again, like a mind-manipulating solution, possibly aerosol delivered, to see how, again, the mind could be utilized. Now, another person that Frank Olson, once I hung out with, because they actually weren't friends, they were sort of, they didn't get on well at all, but they were sort of grudging colleagues, was a man named Andrej Puharich. He was someone who was a captain at the Edgewood, Maryland-based Army Chemical Center, so he knew a great deal about these mind control projects. But Puharich, who wrote a very famous and really good book called The Sacred Mushroom, which deals with how putting your mind into like an altered state can open doorways to other realms. Puharich was someone who came to believe that he was in direct contact with extraterrestrials, and he was speaking to Frank Olson. Now, another example, which actually occurred, or which relates to something that occurred after long after Olson died, was a very famous alleged alien abduction story, which occurred in Pascagoula, Mississippi, in 1973, and involved two men, Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker, who claimed to have seen like a large bright light coming over the Mississippi River when they were out in the early hours fishing. And these small, weird, dwarfish creatures came floating out and took them on board, where they were subjected to a typical abduction scenario. Now, what's interesting is that just literally like 5 or 6 miles from where this event occurred in 73, back in 52, Frank Olson had spent time out there, as I said, just a few miles away, at a place called Horn Island. And Horn Island was where, at the time, a great deal of research was being done into a hallucinatory drug that's become known as BZ, or more appropriately, as Buzz. And this was a drug that could provoke graphic hallucinations, like nightmarish hallucinations. And all this secret development was done just a couple of miles from this the Hicks and Parker abduction a few years later. And we know Olson was out there from the files now. So this doesn't, as I said, this doesn't mean, you know, that all UFOs are fabricated by mind control technology. They're clearly not. But it does demonstrate the possibility that somebody has decided to exploit the UFO phenomenon to see how the mind can be manipulated. Now, everything sort of ended in bad luck for, or actually fatal luck for Olson. This was in 1953, in November 53, November 28th, when he actually fell to his death from a Manhattan hotel room. Unbeknownst to him, his colleagues actually dosed him with LSD earlier, and it had like an adverse effect on him. And that's actually one of the things with LSD that people are always warned. If you take LSD and you're in a negative mindset, then the trip is going to be the worst trip possible. If you get yourself in a relaxed, calm, positive state, it should be okay. Now, Frank Olson himself, not being aware of what had been done to him when the LSD was actually surreptitiously slipped into his drink, he began to wonder what on earth was wrong with him. He panicked. He got into a total fraught state. And over the days ahead, his mindset radically altered for the worst. And he actually had a complete sort of turnaround on the project. He came to think that he was doing something bad, that he shouldn't be messing around with people's minds. It was almost like he had the LSD had given him sort of an epiphany or something where, you know, he changed completely. And there were fears supposedly that he was going to blow the whistle on the project and possibly even blow the whistle on how the UFO subject was being used as a key to test mind-altering technologies. Now, he never had a chance to blow the whistle because, as I said, he fell to his death from a high window in a Manhattan hotel. And whatever secrets he knew went to the grave with him, and unfortunately, that was the end of Frank Olson.
Now, did he actually know the Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal? Was he during that same period of time?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's actually an interesting question because this was 53, just 4 years earlier. The Secretary of Defense at the time, James Forrestal, fell to his death in almost identical circumstances when he fell from the 16th floor of the Bethesda Naval Hospital onto a third-floor canopy roof. And, you know, if you're going to fall 13 floors from a hospital window, you know, you're just not going to survive. It's impossible. And he didn't survive. But the story here is rather like Olson in the sense that Forrestal was supposedly going to blow the whistle on what he knew about the UFO phenomenon in much the same way that Kennedy was supposedly going to do years later. Now, Forrestal had the distinction of being the very first U.S. Secretary of Defense. President Truman gave him the position in 1947. And 1947 was a very interesting year. It was the year in which the flying saucer was born, thanks to Kenneth Arnold's sighting in Washington State on June the 24th. It was also the year in which the CIA was created, the Roswell event occurred, and the National Security Act was passed. And as I said, then we had President Truman assigning Forrestal the position of Secretary of Defense, and the very first Secretary of Defense. Now, Forrestal was a very clever, skilled man, very well-versed in world politics and, you know, understanding the mindset of the Russians, who were clearly, you know, becoming the next big problem on the table, so to speak. But he was also a very emotional person. He had a lot of emotional highs and lows. His wife was an alcoholic who also had sort of a lot of emotional ups and downs as well. So his private life was actually kind of quite stressful. Now, a number of stories have surfaced within the UFO research field that after he'd been given the position of Secretary of Defense, that Forrester was briefed on what was known about the UFO phenomenon at the time. Bear in mind, this was like September 47, and Roswell had only occurred like 6 weeks before. So in other words, there probably wasn't a great deal that he was able to be briefed on beyond the possibility that we've found this strange wreckage, we've got a number of weird little bodies, and we've got a lot of military reports. But that's all we really know. All we know for sure is somebody's sort of skulking around watching us, and they're from somewhere else. So sort of faced with those sort of stark facts, but also faced with the reality that the government probably back then didn't really have a clue, because this was just after the subject began, the government probably didn't really have a clue as to what on earth was going on. And by all accounts, Forrester actually didn't handle the situation very well. He came to believe that we were sort of facing some imminent menacing threat by an alien force that we not only could we not defeat, we just couldn't comprehend. And he actually did begin to descend into like a really bad psychological state that was sort of part stress and part emotional collapse. And it all came to a head. This continued throughout 48, I should say. It all came to a head in early 49 when he had a complete emotional collapse, a complete breakdown. And in March 49, he was admitted to the Bethesda Naval Hospital, reportedly for his own good, but there were fears that, you know, he might take his own life. And so he was placed in a room on the 16th floor, and he had a military guard watching over him, again, just in case, you know, he sort of decided to slash his wrists or something like that. And over the course of the next few weeks, by all accounts, he actually made a very good recovery, to the point where he began to plan what he was going to do with his life and his career when he got out of the hospital, because he felt that there was really no way he could go back to a sort of a high-pressure government job. He was planning his new job, and the military man who was overseeing his room, a man named Edward Price, actually in the U.S. Navy Corps, Forrester had offered him a job as his private private chauffeur, and Price was very much sort of looking forward to this job because the two of them had become friends in the sort of 6 weeks or so that Forrester had been in the hospital. And he was eating well, you know, he was showering, he was shaving. You know, he didn't sound like somebody in depths of depression who just sort of sat on the couch and wouldn't eat for 2 days or shave, or, you know, he was a completely different situation. Now, his brother, Forrestal's brother, Henry Forrestal, was angry at the length of time that his brother, the Secretary of Defense, was kept in the Bethesda Naval Hospital. He kept phoning up, and every time he would demand that his brother be released, a reason would crop up as to why he couldn't be released. And Henry Forrestal finally got sick of this and phoned the hospital on May the 21st, 1949, and said, tomorrow I'm coming to the hospital and I'm taking James home, and whether you like it or not, that's how it's going to be. Now, if, as the rumors suggest, Forrestal was on the verge of revealing what he knew about UFOs, and by revealing, I mean everything, the whole thing, Roswell, dead aliens, and possibly abductions and missing aircraft. The theory is there's no way he would be allowed to say that. And if his brother was going to take him home on the morning of the 22nd, and we're now already into the 21st, it could really only be that later that night when somebody would have time or the opportunity to take him out of circulation. That's exactly what happened, was that on the night in question, Edward Price, who was going to be his chauffeur, was relieved of his duty, and another man was put on duty. Now, the story is that at one point during the night, the man who had relieved Price of watching over Forrestal left the room. And during that time, the official story is that Forrestal took the cord from around his dressing gown, put one end around his neck, tied the other around the radiator, and lowered himself out of the window with the intent of hanging himself, but his weight supposedly snapped the cord and he fell to his death. Now, that's the official story, but there are problems with it. One being that the, you know, he wasn't a huge man. He wasn't, you know, gigantic or anything. And so the cord around his waist from this dressing gown, you know, we're led to believe that it was long enough to go all the way around his neck and also to tie two secure knots. Then to tie the other end around a radiator with two secure knots. Then for it still to be long enough for him to actually climb up out of the window and lower himself out of the window and down the other side. You know, it makes it sound like it was almost like a six-foot-long cord, which would be ridiculous for a dressing gown. So that doesn't make a great deal of sense. But as I said, that was the end of Forrestal. He died on the very night before he was due to be taken home, which would have been probably the first time he would have had the opportunity to really blow the whistle on what he knew about UFOs.
Yeah, well, that sounds very mysterious. No doubt what happened to him. One of the things that I read today was about Pat Price, a remote viewer. I think our audience would love to hear that story.
Yeah, this is another sort of very sinister one that's sort of very much underappreciated in terms of actually what happened to him and possibly even why. Now, the mid-1970s was a period when the whole issue of what became known as remote viewing really came to the fore. Remote viewing, I'm sure most of you listeners know about it, but for those who don't, remote viewing is the idea of using the mind to psychically, essentially, or the military used it, to spy on the Russians. In other words, they would train the remote viewers to sort of psychically spy on the Kremlin and try and pick up, again, through psychic means, snippets of conversations, or possibly even try and read documents, you know, held in classified vaults in the Kremlin. And it sounds like sci-fi, but there's good evidence that a lot of these remote viewers were actually able to achieve much of this. Now, in the mid-70s, there's absolutely no doubt that Pat Price was one of the government's leading remote viewers. And he undertook a lot of missions to psychically spy on the Russians, on the North Koreans, on the Chinese, etc., etc. But there's an interesting UFO connection to Pat Price. During the course of his research, his psychic spying, he inadvertently, not deliberately, but inadvertently and accidentally, came across what he believed was evidence of four or five huge underground and, in some cases, undersea alien installations dotted all around the world. One of them was supposedly buried deep inside Alaska's Mount Hayes. Another one was in Mount Zeal, Australia. One under Mount Injangani in Zimbabwe, and another one in the Pyrenees Mountains between France and Spain. And we don't really know the full extent of what Price told the government about the supposed underground alien bases, only that they seemed to be massive, they were all over the world, and the aliens supposedly looked eerily like us. You know, whoever was running these bases, it wasn't the so-called greys of alien abduction law. They were very human-looking, and unless you were sort of really close up to them, you wouldn't notice the fairly subtle differences. You know, if you saw them from 30, 40 feet away, you just wouldn't notice it at all. Now, Pat Price, as I said, very deeply involved in the regular remote viewing program, spying on the Russians, also uncovering information on UFOs. And certainly we do have rumors that the remote viewers of that period were targeted for assassination by the Soviets and the Chinese, purely and simply because they realized that their skills and powers were real and they wanted rid of them. And it is unfortunate that that Pat Price did have a premature death. Now, Price's death is sort of steeped in controversy, I guess, and mystery. What happened was that in 1974, This was when he was really at the height of his research, and he was sort of going, you know, full steam ahead. And this continued right through to 1975, the summer of 1975, when he was really on top of his game and making a great deal of breakthroughs with his psychic penetration of the Soviets and so on. Now, what happened was that in July 1975, he'd been working in Washington, D.C., having a lot of sort of highly classified meetings with the people who were tasking him to do this research. And from there, he flew on to convoluted route, but he ended up in Nevada, in Las Vegas. And this was actually, the purpose of the visit was to provide a friend of his with a collection of documents that he'd taken from his place of work, which with hindsight probably wasn't a good idea. I think he actually wasn't supposed to remove these documents, but he did. And the plan was to meet in Vegas and hand over these documents. Well, what actually happened was that when he arrived in Las Vegas and he checked into his hotel, which was the Stardust Hotel, this was July the 13th, a man collided with him in the lobby of the hotel. He didn't think about it at the time, but shortly afterwards, Price fell ill. He started sweating and stomach cramps and chest cramps and just didn't feel well. Now, this actually followed on from something else. Just the night before, when he was in a restaurant, he caught sight of someone actually slipping something into his coffee. And the fact that he saw this happen, but didn't let on that he had, meant that he didn't touch the coffee. You know, he was frightened that something had been put in there to sort of, you know, give him a blood clot in his heart or whatever to make it look like a heart attack. So he left the coffee alone. The next day, this guy bumps into him quite violently in the lobby, and then he gets sick afterwards. Now, this actually sounds eerily like something that happened in London, England in 1978, involving a man named Georgi Markov, who'd defected from Bulgaria, who knew a lot of Bulgarian state secrets. And in one day in 78, he was stood at the edge of the road in London, or a road, I should say, when he felt a sudden stabbing pain in the back of his leg. And it was a man who claimed he'd bumped into him. He was holding an umbrella, and he apologized, said he'd sort of bumped into him, lost his balance, and the umbrella had poked him in the leg. But actually, it turned out the guy had a sophisticated weapon, the umbrella being converted into a weapon, and injected him with ricin, which killed him in no time at all. And so there's a possibility this may have been a similar situation with Price, that he was, when this collision occurred in the lobby of the Stardust Hotel, he was sort of clandestinely injected with a fast-acting poison, because Price actually died in the early hours of the next day. He just got sicker and sicker and, you know, and died. And he actually was put down to heart disease, which you know, may well have been the intention all along, you know, make it look like suicide. And of course, the big problem is, as I said, there were so many people who may have wanted him dead, whether the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, and possibly, as I point out in the book, because he'd been targeting these alien bases, it may well have been extraterrestrials that wanted him gone as well. So with so many people on his back and looking to wipe him out, it's almost a wonder he lasted as long as he did, unfortunately. And but as I said, equally unfortunately, he did die premature, and it was very weird circumstances, you know, with this sort of, as I said, somebody putting something in his drink, this weird collision, and, you know, then the heart attack. It all sounds a little bit too strange, and in terms of just, you know, not putting the dots together, that clearly, in my view at least, there was a connection between all these different angles.
Well, let me ask you, Nick, so many things have changed in the last, oh, I'd say 10 years about the UFO movement and ETs, and especially after 2012, it looks like that more and more people are awake on the planet, and that, do you think that more mysterious deaths are going to happen because people are trying to, you know, come out with the truth about what's happening? Or do you think that maybe some of them now are just allowing it to happen because they know it's gone 55 critical mass, and what's the point?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, one of the things I point out in the book is, you know, it's clear that the vast majority of people in the UFO field don't die under mysterious circumstances. You know, they've been thousands of UFO researchers, investigators, authors, magazine writers, bloggers, you know, and most of them, history has shown, they didn't die questionably. So I think that the death cases, which admittedly, you know, there are more than a few dozen, I think this is sort of like the ultimate outcome, possibly where, you know, they're not sort of your average UFO researcher who's just, you know, investigating or compiling a list of sightings of flying triangles or abduction reports in one part of the world. These are people who potentially could blow the whole thing wide open, like Forrest or like Kennedy, possibly like Morris Jessup, who there may have been concerns that he compromised some sort of classified project with UFO links. Same with Pat Price. So in other words, I think when a murder occurs or a disappearance occurs, it's because it's perceived as there's no option, and it's when the person has the ability to really shake things up and blow the whole thing wide open. Now, today, I think there's no reason logically why we shouldn't see that continuing trend that's gone on for the last almost 70 years. But on the other hand, you know, we could make the argument that because the UFO subject, unfortunately, has become so distilled with what I'm sure is deliberate disinformation, sort of sorting out the reality from the disinformation is so difficult that I think a lot of people, for example, in the media and the public, ignore the subject because they perceive it as being just too outlandish. So in other words, I think there could actually be less of a need to wipe people out because there's been such a successful job of saturating the real stuff with outrageous disinformation. And I think the only way it probably would happen would be if somebody really does have hard evidence. You know, let's say some hypothetical, I'm being 100% hypothetical here, but let's say there was a scientist working at a secure military facility and his job was to autopsy an alien body. Well, let's say he was successfully able to take photographs and possibly even sneak a piece of DNA of the alien out of the base and give it to a leading DNA specialist who would be able to confirm that it wasn't, you know, from anything on the planet. That would arguably blow the whole thing wide open. So I think it's people like that who have a lot to fear rather than the average UFO researcher who's more on the outside looking in rather than being on the inside looking out, so to speak.
Yeah. Okay, good. Oh, this has been so fascinating, and I realize what time it is, and so I need to turn this over to Arielle now because she has the switchboard and people that are probably wanting to talk to you or ask you some questions. Are you up for a few questions before we end?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay, and back to you, Arielle. Thank you so much, Nick, for coming on and talking to us about this. And you have another book coming up besides this one, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind. What is the next book that you're working on?
We'll have a book coming out in September, which was a co-authored one with Brad Steiger. It's called The Zombie Book, and it's like an A to Z of everything to do with zombies in movies, TV, novels, history, folklore, mythology, you know, going right back to the ancient days of the Egyptians when they would try and revive the dead, and New Orleans voodoo and Haitian voodoo techniques. So in other words, it's like an across-the-board study of zombies, everything from raising the dead to real-life viruses and things that mimic zombies, kind of like the rabies virus in its final stages. So, you know, sort of like a pop culture look at everything to do with zombies.
Yeah, okay, good. Well, we'll have you back on after your book comes out in September. So, Arielle, do we have anybody on the switchboard that wants to talk to Nick?
Well, we do, and there you are. Okay. This is a question from Ralph, and just let me get your mic open. Hello, Ralph. How are you?
Hello, Ariel. Thank you very much for taking my question.
You're so welcome.
I did have a question for Nick, and I was just wondering, Nick, if you heard of Robert Duncan, who wrote the book The Matrix Deciphered.
Hey, Ralph. I actually don't. No,
okay.
I haven't seen that.
I'm sorry. Yeah, he talks about some of the things you were addressing in terms of mind control, and though you mentioned a lot about the chemical inducements that cause mind control, he actually worked for, I think it was the Department of Defense, and he kind of became a whistleblower, so to speak, and talked about some of the EEG, what he calls EEG heterodyning, that synchronizes with brain waves. It uses radar and EEG, and they have a software that has, they kind of perfected this now, where people hear voices, and it's actually not coming from that person. People think it's coming from within them, but it's just voices in their head that have that are being transmitted from this particular system. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, I actually have heard about that. There's actually a formally classified Defense Intelligence Agency document in the public domain that actually talks about how way back in the 70s there were suspicions that the Soviets were trying to develop technologies to, as they called it, intracranially dispatch voices, you know, essentially like schizophrenia, where a person would hear voices in the head and they could actually be directed to perform or commit certain acts. And as amazing as it sounds, this document is dated from 75 and surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act. So, you know, if we look back at 75, that's 40 years ago practically.
Right.
Who knows where that technology might be today?
Well, where it is now is that not only do they send waves into the brain, but it actually can now can synchronize with the brain and actually read the thoughts of people, which is kind of scary. I just wanted to mention that because people who are hearing voices, who are somehow thinking they're going crazy, don't necessarily have to be going crazy. They need to give that a second thought. And,
I think you're right. And thanks for letting me know that, because I actually wasn't aware of that book. But I'll get a copy and check it out. I think there's far more to mind manipulation than we've even begun to imagine, really.
Oh yeah. And the other thing was you mentioned that people were seeing flying saucers and not flying saucers. You said little green men running around and so forth. At some village.
Yeah, in France, yeah.
Right. There's some pretty sophisticated holographic equipment, some holographic technology now that can produce project these images where they actually look really 3D real until you, of course, get up close and your hand goes through them. But from a short distance, they really seem real. And someone had even said that perhaps the planes that hit the towers weren't really planes, that they were actually holographic projections. I didn't believe that at first. I thought that was kind of far-fetched until I saw this demonstration in Japan where in this kind of a museum or I can't remember exactly where it was, but it actually has a film. It's online. Has a film of holographic technology where children can actually pet the animals because they actually think that they're real. It's just unbelievable. It's, so that technology also is very advanced now and being used, of course, by the military, but it's also even being used in civilian society. I didn't know which book to start reading. You actually have a library of books that you've written, but which one would you suggest if were to start with one?
My books, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe the new one. The main reason being not just because it sort of, deals with some of the things you've talked about, but because it sort of covers a lot of different aspects of the phenomenon. Like, for example, I talk about, missing aircraft in relation to mysterious deaths, but there are also, abduction and close encounter stories that ended in death, and UFO crashes and stories of alien viruses. So, in other words, it's not just, a collection of a bunch of people who all fell to the death out of a window or whatever, There's a
right.
Each chapter is actually quite, even though they all ended in death, each chapter sort of deals pretty much with a very different aspect of the phenomenon, from abductions to UFO crashes to close encounters to people being taken on board a UFO and then subsequently having such experiences, things like that.
Now, that brings a question real quick. Are you actually, have you been receiving threats for your writings or not?
No, I actually haven't, and I think that sort of goes to what I mentioned earlier about, you know, being on the outside looking in. I think, you know, clearly because there have been thousands of UFO researchers over the years, and most of them haven't died in questionable circumstances, is because, unfortunately, I wish it was different, but unfortunately, you know, we don't have a piece of an alien body or a piece of alien wreckage. And that's why I think it's the ones who do, or the ones who have the potential to blow it open, are the ones who have to worry, like Kennedy, like Forrestal, like Olson. You know, the average UFO researcher, unless they get something hard evidence, which, you know, I'll be the first to admit I don't have, you know, it's essentially our word against somebody else's word. And in that sense, there is no direct threat where the researcher, you know, is perceived as a threat, unless it's sort of really mitigated circumstances, like with Maurice Jessup. So I think that's probably the reason why most researchers, you know, don't get these sort of really dark threats, because the people on the other side know that the person isn't a threat because they really don't have anything beyond a collection of stories. It doesn't mean the stories aren't true, but it means, unfortunately, we're not able to prove them. And I think when we're not able to prove it, that sort of provokes like a sigh of relief on the other side, because they know that the secret's still going to remain kept.
That's very interesting. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I enjoyed the show.
All right, thanks a lot.
Have a good night.
You too.
Thanks for calling, Ralph. It's good to hear from you. Bye-bye. Well, you know, it's true. You do have so many books, Nick, that it really would depend on your area of interest, because you've just covered so many fascinating subjects and unsolved mysteries, and you've always caught...
Yeah, sorry, go on.
I say you just always got such great stories, and your research is really solid. So, I commend you for that.
Well, thanks. There's two main interests I have. One is the UFO subject, and the other is cryptozoology, which is the study of unknown animals like Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, the Chupacabra, and so on. But, you know, the view I've always taken is, if you're going to write a book and people are going to buy it, you want to be able to, and they're going to spend dollars on it, you know, that you want to be able to give them something fresh and a new approach. And it's like with the new book, nobody had ever written a full-length book that looked into this sort of catalogue of weird deaths from the 40s right to the present day. So I always put a lot of thought into what I'm going to write about, because, you know, you want to be able to give the reader something new. And so that's why I spend sort of as much time planning the subject as I do writing about it. You know, is there going to be enough new material? Are there going to be enough unseen data, you know, that makes warrants writing a book about this rather than just going over old ground? So, you know, a lot to sort of think about when you're actually working on a book itself.
Well, very few people would go to the trouble that you have. You know, I mean, you've traveled to areas and, you know, talked to the local people, as well as, taking documents and tie in the thread. Most people are not going to go through all that. And when you put all the pieces together, then it does give you some new things to think about.
Well, the reason I do that is because when I finished school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I got a job offer working on a rock music magazine back in England. I did that for a few years, and I actually still do quite a lot of that to this day. I do a lot of regular mainstream music-based journalism for magazines and newspapers. But when I got that job, which was the initial job was for 2 years, they sort of taught me in all the different areas of investigative journalism, interview techniques, and so on. So I sort of, when I began writing the books, I decided to use those same techniques, you know, that investigate a UFO story or a Bigfoot case in the same way if a newspaper editor was asking me to write an article on a local murder in town, or, you know, somebody got killed in a car accident, in the same way that you would write a feature or a news story on it, use those same techniques of investigation and interviewing to get to the heart of that particular UFO story. So that's what I've always tried to do, is although the story might be unusual, it doesn't, you know, it still means you can use regular media interviewing techniques to try and figure it all out.
Well, sure, it's the method and technique, as you say, and I think that probably is recognized by other journalists as well. You know, people in the field of investigative journalism can see your adherence to these techniques, and you've really done a lot of major television appearances, and I would imagine that's kind of related, that you have that respect because of the quality of your investigation and, you know, fresh look at other topics that maybe have been written about, but not from this angle. So,
Well, thanks. I mean, it is one of these things where, you know, I always try and take a responsible stance of letting people know what we know for sure, what we think we know, what might be hearsay and rumor, and what is hard fact. You know, I try not to melt them all together into one. I try and point out to people, you know, if we've got a document that surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act, I tell people that's where it came from. If, like with the Milo Spiriglio, Marilyn Monroe story, the document reportedly leaked to Spiriglio, I make that clear as well. You know, I don't try and dress it up as something it isn't. And I think it's important to do that, that, you know, people understand what the data is, where it's all coming from, so they get a full, clear picture, not a distorted one. You know, the last thing we need is to be distorting the subject when we're getting pumped with disinformation,
right.
You know, to make it even more unclear anyway. The last thing we need to be doing is making it even more foggy, if you like.
Right. Well, and, you know, if you do that, you just lose your credibility. So,
yeah.
You know,
I don't mind. Really, you know, if somebody says to me, look, you can use the story, but please don't use my name. And, you know, I always do that. If somebody says to me, you know, you can print the story or you can talk about it, but don't ever reveal who I am, you know, I'm happy to do that. I've had, you know, this chiefly in my case relates to people, not military people or government people, but chiefly it relates to like abductees or contactees who might have responsible jobs like lawyers or whatever, and they just don't want, unfortunately, you know, to be tied to the UFO phenomenon publicly. And so sort of mindful of their jobs or their families or their status, you know, I'm happy not to reveal that information. And now, unfortunately, some people say, well, if you don't reveal the name, how do we know you just didn't make it up? Well, you know, that's an unfortunate approach. And I think people should realize more that for the witnesses, there is a great deal of potential stress involved in going public. And when they do so and they reveal their name, it is a very brave thing to do. I'm not sure even I would be willing to do that. So I think, you know, I think it's pretty stupid when people say a story is not credible because the person didn't want to go public. Well, how many people would want to go in the limelight and say they'd had an alien encounter? It may not be that many, you know, so I don't actually hold that against the witnesses, and I try and point out in the books as to the reasons why somebody I've interviewed, you know, doesn't want to go on the record, and it's, you know, generally it's a logical, understandable reason.
Right. Well, there have been decades of ridicule engineered and aimed at keeping those people either quiet or make them look like lunatics to discredit them. So, I mean, yeah, you really have to know who you're talking to and what the repercussions of that conversation might be.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a lot for people to think about. I mean, I always encourage people, if you've got a great story to tell, write your own book. People love first-hand, you know, first-person written books. But I think when people do, what I've noticed is that they then begin to appreciate, you know, what you have to do to write a book to make it readable, and also to get across to the reader exactly what it is you want to say and what's important to say. And I actually know a number of people who found the whole process of writing a book about their own experiences actually to be quite sort of gratifying and a weight off their shoulders, because they know it's going to be read by, you know, people who are of a similar mindset, who share their beliefs and who can relate to what they've got to say and going to sort of empathize with them. And, you know, it can be like a good, like a cathartic experience for them to actually sit down and write that book.
Right, or even, you know, just the story, it doesn't have to be a whole book, but just writing it down sometimes can be very therapeutic.
Yeah, that's true. And, I mean, I've done that sometimes with stories where, you know, I've written about 30 books. I've probably got about 6 or 7 books that sort of stalled halfway, you know, where I was writing all the data up, and I could only get so far with it. You know, it was like I just reached a brick wall, and try as hard as I could, I just could not get past it. And so, you know, these are sort of very much unfinished stories that maybe one day will be finished, or maybe they won't. You know, it'll just be fragments of a fascinating story that I just, you know, I just could not get to the heart of it. So.
Well, I think even Beethoven had an unfinished symphony, so
That's true.
Well, Nick, I want to thank you so much for sharing your new work with us. And Lavendar, do you have anything to add before we wrap up?
Yes, I'd like to say that we do have the meetings at the Tetons on July 1 through 7 inside the mountain, and a lot of people listening to this will be attending. And so next Tuesday, that we're going to have our Starseed Crystal Quest stories from our May adventure. So I just wanted to mention that. And to, you know, just stay awake, alert, and be ready for the next high strangeness.
Right. And you can read more about the Teton meetings in our vault on our website if you don't know what that is. But it actually started today. So, Nick Redfern, thank you so much for joining us. And once again, people can contact you at, let me get this right, Nick Redfern, R-E-D-F-E-R-N, Fortean, F-O-R-T-E-A-N, .blogspot.com. Did I get it right?
Yep, that's correct. Or people can also just, if you just type in Nick Redfern at Facebook, there's actually like 9 or 10 Nick Redferns, but scroll down and you'll see me somewhere there. So.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and I want to thank Vanya and Claudia for helping us with the switchboard this evening, and we will be back next week. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye,
thanks,
everyone.
A lot.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.